Good morning again. So thrilled you're here. I love this season of Advent, and we want to sink in to this. But we always like to do some toast around here when we figure out that there may be somebody who's up to something, or maybe it's birthdays. And so we will catch a birthday, and we'll just make sure that we cheers some folk. So if we look to our... somewhere there, are you hiding in the back there is Chris Pavlisu, will be 14 years old tomorrow. Yeah. So hey Chris, good to see you. Well done there. Let's make 14 awesome for you. So thanks for being here, thanks for being a part. So Chris, cheers. Anybody else have any birthdays? Adam's birthday today, but he's, so he's not here, so no toast for you. Sorry. Abe's is this Wednesday. It was this past Wednesday. It was in the middle of the week, and we were not together. Yeah, but now that's right, because I was like, we were texting birthday stuff. So it's fine. No, middle of the week. So you're already a half week into this new. Great.
You're right.
But for Abe, we do. Abe. Abe, who keeps us on our toes. What's that? First wedding anniversary. Elizabeth and Ryan. Happy anniversary. Today? Today?
No, Tuesday.
Tuesday. Oh, fantastic. Well done there. So Tuesday at 10:30 a.m. You better believe it. That is good. I love it. All right. Well, we have a lot to sink into this morning, as is always the case. So I'd love to dive in. I'd love to just pause and say a brief word of prayer, if we can, and recalibrate ourselves to listen. Gracious God, you are good. You are here. You are love. May we now, God, each one of us, have our heads, our hearts open to what you have for us. May the meditation and posture of my heart, God, and the words then of my mouth bring honor and glory to you and you alone. We bless you, God, for this time, this season, this place, which is about people and finding our way back to you. We give this time to you in the name of Christ Jesus. And the church said, amen, amen. Amen. So we are doing a brief Advent series. I say brief because 4 weeks, that feels very brief to me, but Advent series, and we're calling it King of Kings. So King of Kings, which though I think the idea of King of Kings, even the words King of Kings in America outside of a religious context, we don't say things like this. That doesn't make any sense to us. But the idea of competing king types sadly takes zero imagination for us, right? We are clubbed over the head with it time and time again in all sorts of ways, which is just one example of why we need the depth of Advent in this season to jolt our imaginations to something better and more true. And so and this isn't a time joke, but no joke, it would be really good for us to take an hour to have a big group discussion around the message of Advent, but alas, we cannot. So we will not do that. So I just want to take a few minutes up front and use one of the most helpful, but also one of the most familiar Advent texts to give us a framework for the rest of our study that we will be in this morning. So with that, we're going to turn to the Hebrew prophet Isaiah, who often gets a lot of attention at this time of the year. And he begins by encouraging the people he is writing to seek truth and inquire of the divine. But Isaiah points out that if searching among false gods or gods that are lifeless, they will simply lead to a dead end, an alleyway that is simply dark. But then he shifts and he begins to speak of the God who is going to do a new thing, the God preparing to step into the darkness. And in chapter 9, verses 1 through 7, we get this. Nevertheless, Isaiah says, there will be no more gloom for those who were in distress. In the past, he humbled the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali, but in the future, he will honor Galilee of the nations. By the way of the sea, beyond the Jordan, the people walking in darkness have seen a great light. On those living in the land of deep darkness, a light has dawned. You have enlarged the nation and increased their joy. They rejoice before you as people rejoice at the harvest, as soldiers rejoice when dividing the plunder. For as in the day of Midian's defeat, you have shattered the yoke that burdens them, the bar across their shoulders, the rod of their oppressor. Every warrior's boot used in battle and every garment rolled in blood will be destined for burning, will be fuel for the fire. For to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government will be on his shoulders, and he will be called, as we sang, Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and peace, there will be no end. He will reign on David's throne and over his kingdom, establishing and upholding it with justice and righteousness. Such an important words for this morning. From that time on and forever, the zeal of the Lord Almighty will accomplish this. So now what we need is context, context, context. The region the prophet has spoken of is here. So we go to a map. We have in here, up in this region, I knocked over the tree. It's not uprooted. Now then, we have in this area, you have Capernaum, Kephar, Nahum, Bethsaida, because what you have here is the Sea of Galilee, which is a lake. So it's a lake here of Galilee. You have the Galilee region, but then you have this other area, Jezreel Valley, that was mentioned in the text. You have this area that Isaiah is speaking into. And it's really important as we go into it, when you are in Israel and you're in this area called Galilee, and when it says Galilee of the nations, why would it say Galilee of the nations? Because the Galilee region was a gateway from the east to the west. If you were to move west to east, east to west in the ancient world, you would often have to go through that region of the Galilee. Even though it's this small region, it is this gateway. So they would refer to it as is the gateway of the nations, because it connects the nations. If you wanted to participate in global trade, you would go through the Galilee region. If you wanted to get a message out to all the ends of the earth, then you would go through the Galilee of the regions. Oh, and so where does Jesus make 90%+ of his public ministry? In Galilee of the nations. Where is his home when he was doing his public ministry? Capernaum. This region there would be all sorts of people moving in and out. And if a message was taking place, if something was happening, then that would end up going to the ends of the earth from that place. The thing would move out. Make sense? It's really, really good. So that's why Jesus does this. Then you have the Jezreel Valley, which is in its context, when Isaiah's writing, it has a very large and violent history at the time. From the city of Megiddo, which is in there, you see Megiddo on here. From this city, and you're looking out, overlooking the Jezreel Valley, you would be looking at an area that had been destroyed 26 times through wars, this area. Hence Isaiah's war rhetoric we get in his poem kind of here, and in images of bloody garments and warrior's boots, because this valley is essentially a landfill of war with all the wars that had taken place. In fact, the hill or valley of Megiddo would later be spoken of as an ominous metaphor for the darkness of war. By the way, Mount or hill of Megiddo. In Hebrew is Har Megiddo. When transliterated, it is the word Armageddon. This is where we get Armageddon. This is actually literally Armageddon. This valley coming from this hill, that's where it comes from. John the Revelator will speak of this later on and uses that word. Are you with me? So it's a picture, it's an image of chaos. And the prophet says, in view of this place, centered in and around the region of Galilee, a light will dawn. Brilliant is what the poet is here, and what the prophet is. In the midst of darkness, in the midst of war, in a place that you know is utter chaos, there will be a light that dawns. And that light will have some names, some ways we refer to it. Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, will be repurposed. What a gorgeous and much needed picture, yes? Can you see why an hour on this would be much, much better? That we could sink into this a bit more. The prophet offers a sweeping, massive picture of goodness and peace that is on the horizon, with the prophet's goal to fill the people's imagination with a vision of what true justice and righteousness looks like. Justice and righteousness not filled with violence, but the swallowing up of violence by a way of wisdom, the names, fatherhood, peace, which is all held by the power of the divine or in the power of the divine. That is a picture, and we need to hold on to that while we consider a really key word, imagination. Now, I don't know about you, but when I was a kid, I had a huge imagination. I had a really big imagination. I used to constantly dream up all sorts of scenarios of playing the hero. I loved the underdog story. I would think up of the underdog overtaking the powers that be. I would dream this stuff up. I would think of rescue. I was sparked by movies like the original Star Wars, which is actually called A New Hope. Yes, big word, loved it. Great. And then, if not then Star Wars, how about the Goonies? Hey, you guys. Ruth, Ruth, baby, Ruth. Sloth, yes, great, love it. The Goonies, oh, it would get under there. Because what are these movies about? They're about the underdog and the seemingly less overcoming empire. When I was in eighth grade, I was absorbed by what would become my favorite book, S.E. Hinton's The Outsiders. And then that same year, in eighth grade, I saw the movie. And these people, this cast, oh, goodness, when I saw that movie. And what it was, though, is for me, it took the labels of social classes, like greasers and socias, and it flattened them. And when Johnny tells Ponyboy to stay gold, everything in me craved justice and righteousness. We're not playing by the labels that society puts on people. We're doing something different. And it was like, come on. So each year, I still read The Outsiders. 15 years ago, I got a special edition book while I was in California, and when I found it, oh, it was like Christmas on steroids. I'm like, oh, that's great. And my sons have read the book, except for Jude. He's getting there. We put a time frame. Then, when they read the book, they may watch the movie, and we sit and we do that together, because something is going on, but those are good. Those are good. We're leveling some social class things. Good, good, good. Some. We got an underdog story. Great, great, great. But being a true child of the 80s, and by the 80s, we're going back to the 1900s. The 1980s. 1980s, being a true child, there was a filmmaker I thought took things much deeper. This is the legend of John Hughes. Look at this guy. I mean, all you see right there is creativity, right? Fantastic sweater vest. Good heavens. It makes it all the better this guy, he gifted us with 16 candles in Pretty in Pink, Ferris Bueller's Day Off, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, Uncle Buck, National Lampoon's Vacation and Christmas Vacation, as well as a small film called Home Alone. This is John Hughes, born February 18, 1950 in Lansing, Michigan. He grew up in Grosse Pointe as a huge Detroit Red Wings fan, with his three sisters and mom, who volunteered in charity work while his dad worked in sales. Of his childhood, John said this: I grew up in a neighborhood that was mostly girls and old people. There weren't any boys my age, so I spent a lot of my time by myself imagining things. Come on. With a sparked imagination, he would transcend the underdog story into something more. When you look into his films, there is such a taking apart of social labels. So as all great prophetic voices do, he took the social classes and static categories and he tilled them into a soil that could sprout something far more beautiful. Probably best revealed in his groundbreaking film, The Breakfast Club, in which Hughes scribbled on all aspects of classism. The movie took all the social categories for teenagers and he pulled them apart. It wasn't about any one of them, it was about the humanity underneath all of them. The raw honesty and vulnerability melted the facade of a plastic society. It is the gift of great storytelling and the spark of the prophet to speak into the shallow and the status quo. It is the gift of metaphor and the gift of art. Are you with me? Now then, back to the scriptures. So, during this time of year, all throughout the world, people will be reading the words of the Hebrew prophet Isaiah, who wrote in anticipation of the root of Jesse sprouting and the child who would be born to us. But I find it helpful to back up further and develop what will be the message of the divine that comes in this one. So in Isaiah chapter 2, verse 3 and 4, it says this: many peoples will come and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. He will teach us his ways so that we may walk in his paths. The law will go out from Zion, the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He will judge between the nations and will settle disputes for many peoples. They will beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation will not take up sword against nation, nor will they even train for war anymore. The words of the prophet speak the vision of a new creation, one without division and violence of wars, both in words spoken and in deeds or actions. The prophet speaks of a world governed by justice and righteousness. So when I felt called and compelled to teach the Bible, this is one of the things I wanted to simply create space for. The divine new creation is both a tsunami and a balm to the soul. Balm to a people who are constantly buried in chaos and violence, whether by word or deed. These writings, especially those that tell of the unfettering life and teachings of Jesus, should electrify the imagination and echo through the chambers of one's heart. Are you with me? The writings of the prophets and the life of Jesus are to catapult our stories into a new stratosphere. It happens every day in every small and big city alike. Empire flexes, and the voice of the prophet cries out in the midst of it. So the question is, who will have ears to hear the prophet crying out? Now, Darth Vader and the Death Star are impressive, but the characters and settings surrounding Jesus being born into this world are unmatched. So we're going to jump into some of the context of our scripture, the culture and characters that surround the birth of Jesus. At the time of Jesus' birth, there were two people in particular who stood as figures of power in that ancient world: Herod the Great and Caesar Augustus. With the Caesar taking us into our main scriptural text for this morning, Luke chapter 2, verses 1 and 3. In those days, at that time, Caesar Augustus issued a decree that a census should be taken of the entire Roman world, which, by the way, in their minds is what? Just about the entire world at that time. Pretty close. This was the first census that took place while Quirinius was governor of Syria, and everyone went to their own town to register. First, what's the deal with a census? Well, from the time of Julius Caesar, who was killed in 44 BCE, the Galilean Jewish peasant rendered roughly 12.5% of their crops annually to Rome, except in sabbatical years, because they knew we can't tax them, they don't have anything, because they didn't pick anything. They were also taxed another 12.5% to pay the high priest of the capital city of the Galilee region, which is a city called Sepphoris, which was the neighbor city to Nazareth. Those two tributes put taxes at 25% of the annual income. Combined that with their Jerusalem taxes and then their temple taxes in Jerusalem, piled on top of that, taxation was upwards of 90% of a peasant Galilean Jewish person in the first century. And you thought our taxes stink. 90%. Welcome to the reality of a common peasant Galilean in the first century. Now hold on to that as we look at how the census demanded some things. What did it do? Next slide. Everyone, it says, okay, we're going to take a census. Well, then everyone has to go to their own town to register. So what does that mean? So Joseph also went up from the town of Nazareth in Galilee to Judea, to Bethlehem, the town of David, because he belonged to the house and line of David. So then, the wording of this text is confusing to the actual geography, because Bethlehem is south of Nazareth. But in Jewish consciousness, to move towards the temple in Jerusalem is always to go up. No matter where you are in the world, if you're heading towards Jerusalem, then you're going up. It's just something to know when you're reading the Bible and you're like, oh, okay, going up. How come Jerusalem is just always up? Or that region, that area, yep. So he has to go down from Nazareth to Bethlehem. So we have to go to a map and look at this idea of Nazareth down to Bethlehem is what he would travel. But here's the thing. He's already a poor person, so he has to travel this far. An impoverished Joseph now has to pay for a trip for he and his pregnant wife to go for this distance. This trip would be at least 3 days' journey, but if we actually go to a second map, it gives us a better idea of the route that he would probably take, because what they wouldn't want to do is, in that earlier one, they wouldn't want to go through Samaria or Samaria. They don't want to do that. There is this Jewish-Samaritan kind of rub. So what you do is you'd go down this direction, which actually means the journey is probably going to be 4, maybe even 5 days journey for them. So they got to pay for that. And to highlight the financial reality of Joseph and Mary, we will actually later read in chapter 2 of Luke, verses 22 to 24, we read this. When the time came after Jesus was born, the purification rites were required by the law of Moses. Joseph and Mary took him to Jerusalem to present him to the Lord, as it is written in the law of the Lord. Every firstborn male is to be consecrated to the Lord and to offer a sacrifice in keeping with what is said in the law of the Lord, a pair of doves or two young pigeons. Now, the reason that is in quotes, a pair of doves or two young pigeons, is because in Leviticus 12, you haven't memorized, but I'll just highlight, that it says that a family is to offer a lamb. Unless they are poor, then you can offer the much cheaper birds. So the fact that Joseph and Mary offer birds tells us they ain't got no money. Are you with me? So these few verses are loaded with all sorts of political, economic, religious tension. Specifically in the first century, because there's a census, most obedient Jews would object to paying taxes to Caesar and Rome, as that would be viewed as an acknowledgement or an affirmation that Caesar is Lord. So what do you do? Do you pay? Because, oh, by the way, if you don't pay, someone, a Roman soldier, will show up and say pay or else. What do you do? As stated well by scholar and Christian historian Richard Horsley, he says this: to have a decree of an alien imperial census juxtaposed with the birth of the Messiah is the height of political, economic, religious conflict. The Messiah now being born would lead the people's successful resistance against the false and intolerable lordship in subjection. Come on, Richard Horsley. And oh, by the way, that book there, The Infancy Narratives, The Liberation of Christmas, like that's how every sentence is. So you read it, and then you read it again, and then you take a nap, and then you come back to the next paragraph. It's so good, and it takes forever to get through. Maybe it took me a couple Christmases, but I love it. Anyways, I don't know about you, but I can hear the brilliant and haunting message through the voice of like Star Wars in this thing. Like, oh yeah. Take your pick of stories that portray a character from a small village who will rise up against the boot of empire from the oppressed. To keep that tension boiling, we now ask, good question, next slide. If Joseph is from the little town of Bethlehem, why has he been living in Nazareth? Because he's going back there. You don't leave home in the first century ancient world like that. A son builds onto his father's house. He adds rooms to it and lives there with his wife and kids. So why is he in Nazareth? Good question, thank you. As a vocation, we are told that Joseph is a what? Carpenter, but the Greek word is tekton. Tekton is any craftsman, workman, joiner, or builder. That's what he is called, a tekton. Now, in the first century Middle Eastern context, builders did very little with wood, working mostly with stone. So as a tekton, Joseph is constantly and often mostly would be working with stone. So now we got to put some contextual pieces together. We land on why most scholars have him in Nazareth. Around the end of the first century BCE, Rome was in the midst of putting down a second of what would be by the year 136 CE, four significant Jewish revolts against the imperial conquests of Israel. First century historian, Jewish historian Flavius Josephus writes this about that second revolt. The Roman troops captured and burned the city of what? Sepphoris, 4 miles from Nazareth, and reduced its inhabitants to slavery. And as a result of this military conquest, next slide, the more efficient combatants were at length exterminated, and the rest of the population was then massacred in the open or in their houses, young and old alike. For no males were spared except infants. These, along with the women, the Romans sold as slaves. The slain mounted to 15,000. The captives numbered 2,130. Why does this matter? Well, shortly after the death of Herod the Great in 4 BCE, his son was given the rulership of the Galilee region. And as mentioned before, this Herod Antipas is his name, rebuilt Sepphoris. Okay? 4 BCE, his dad dies, he takes control, I got to rebuild Sepphoris because it's been burned down and ruined. So he does that. So the question then is, if Sepphoris again serving as the capital of the Galilee and the Perea for Rome, that was the capital, and they burned it down, so now we got to rebuild it. We go back to our first map to see where Sepphoris is. You see it right next to Nazareth, 4 miles, 3 to 4 miles from that. We find an incredible thing in Sepphoris when it's being rebuilt. So now some pictures to take us there. Even today, a stunning Roman road that is in Sepphoris. Then we go to a large theater that was in Sepphoris. So this massive theater was in built up there. And the next slide, here's the thing. If you're sitting in the theater and you're looking up over the hill, guess what you're looking at? The village of Nazareth. Now, when they do further excavations, they find this in Nazareth. Nazareth, even to this day, has a number of stone quarries in it. It's a natural, it has all these stone quarries in it, which is really important because the stone quarries are of limestone. And guess when the city of Sepphoris was rebuilt, guess what the majority of that city, the roads you saw, the theater you saw, guess what they're built out of? Limestone. Yep. So if you got to rebuild a city, you got a stone quarry in Nazareth, and if you're Roman, you go, I would like to do this as cheap as possible, though, as in how we hire people, what you do is you hire local Jewish tectons to do the work, which leads many scholars to Joseph, with the possible help of his son, Jesus, who is also described as having being a tecton. And with further excavation of the neighboring Nazareth, then, you have the stone quarries, limestone, which was the main stone used to build it up. So what you do is you live in Nazareth, and you're able to haul all of this limestone over to Sepphoris and rebuild the city. Are you with me? Context matters just a bit. So when we excavate the context of this familiar and very hallmark precious text in Luke, our minds and hearts should be assaulted with the reality that the text is actually less precious and more revolutionary. One of the questions the context raises is, what sense does a census make? Rome is doing this. What does this do? Why on earth are you doing a census of all of these people? Why? It's the same as I highlighted when we were talking about Egypt and what Pharaoh was doing. What's a census all about? Money, money, money. We're going to find out how many people there are so we know how many people ought to give us money. The Caesar and Rome, to them, the peasant Jewish people were less human and they were more dollar signs. They didn't see them as humans. Those are opportunities for us to gouge them of money. They could enslave them to build up their cities, and they could tax them to build up their military and their roads. With empire, key, dignity is not given, it's always taken. Empire takes dignity. I would say it like this: to empire, people are simply tools for access to excess. So empire views people. You can get us more. And at this time, which, by the way, is known as the golden age of the Roman Empire, a Jewish boy was born to an impoverished teenaged couple who were publicly understood to be socially shameful in their relationship. And this baby is called King of Kings? This child is the one who has been anticipated for hundreds of years? Really? So what is this king's competing message to the mighty Roman Empire? I would say it like this. Although your kingdom counts every person, not every person actually counts. Rome. You count people for money, but not every person actually matters to you at all. If you pay attention to the life and teachings of Jesus, the posture that infuriates Rome is how Jesus shows no regard for the social structure that Rome provided. Jesus refuses to place people in boxes of rich and poor, in and out. He refuses to do it, and Rome gets furious. How dare you step on our social classes? How dare you ignore our social classes? Which, of course, takes us back to the spark that galvanizes the prophet. justice and righteousness, which is what is desperately needed for the anemic imagination of our current culture and society. Which takes us to you and I here today. One way for us to get at some of this is to ask a couple questions. First, if all of my prayers were answered with a yes, does that make the world a better place for everyone else? What kingdom would that bring? And who would it be for? Which takes us back to the stories that catapult us into something more. When the prophet speaks and people are lit up in their soul, when they are caught with the good news of Jesus, they give their lives for something bigger and more. We saw this in the prophets, and we see this in good prophetic work with art and poetry, in action, the way people live their lives. And to me, that takes... We need more. We need to hear more of the stories of people who live a certain way. And so that takes me to this lady, Pauli Murray. She's born Anna Pauline Murray on November 20, 1910 in Baltimore, Maryland. Both sides of her family were of mixed racial origins, with ancestors that included black slaves, white slave owners, Native Americans, Irish, and free black people. It's her ancestry. Much later in her adult life, the varied features and complexions of her family were described as a United Nations in miniature. Her mother died of a cerebral hemorrhage when she was 3 years old. Her dad was placed in a Negro mental institution after a bout with typhoid fever. There, her father was bludgeoned to death by a white guard with a baseball bat when Pauli was 13 years old. She was then moved to Durham, North Carolina, to be raised by relatives on her mom's side. At the age of 16, she moved to New York City to live with a cousin's family who could pass as white. Although she experienced significant racism and discrimination, she graduated high school with honors and went on to get her BA in English in 1933. In 1940, she and a friend moved off of the broken seats that they were sitting in the black section of a bus, and they moved into the white section only, and they were arrested for breaking segregation laws. This incident was a spark that led her to pursue her career goal of working as a civil rights lawyer. She enrolled in the law school at Howard University, where she was the only female in her class. Murray graduated first in the class of 1944, but she was denied the chance to do postgraduate work at Harvard University because she was a woman. So she went west and earned a master's degree in law at the University of California, Berkeley. In 1965, she became the first African-American to receive a Doctor of Juridical Science degree from Yale Law School. She would go on to become a prominent civil rights lawyer and activist, a women's rights lawyer and activist, and then an accomplished poet and author. In 1950, Thurgood Marshall called Murray's book, States, Laws on Race and Color, the Bible of the Civil Rights Movement. Still wanting to give her life to creating space for others, and increasingly sparked by her connections with other women in the Episcopal Church, Murray, then in her 60s, attended General Theological Seminary. There she received a Master of Divinity in 1976 with her thesis, Black Theology and Feminist Theology, a Comparative Review. After 3 years of study, Murray became the first black woman ordained an Episcopal priest in 1977. That year, she celebrated her first Eucharist by invitation and preached her first sermon at the Chapel of the Cross, which was the first time a woman celebrated the Eucharist at an Episcopal church in North Carolina. In 1978, she preached in her hometown of Durham, North Carolina, on Mother's Day at St. Philip's Episcopal Church, where her mother and grandparents had attended in the 19th century. There she announced her mission would be of reconciliation. For the next 7 years, Murray worked in a parish in Washington, D.C., focusing particularly on ministry to the sick. On July 1, 1985, she died of pancreatic cancer at the age of 74. Her memoir is called Song in a Weary Throat, was published posthumously in 1987. In it, Dr. Reverend Pauli Murray writes this: "All the strands of my life had come together, descendant of a slave and of a slave owner. I had already been called poet, lawyer, teacher, and friend. Now I was empowered to minister the sacrament of one in whom there is no north or south, no black or white, no male or female, only the spirit of love and reconciliation, drawing us all toward the goal of human wholeness." Come on, Pauli. Now, she writes this, and then in one of her recorded sermons, she said this: "Bearing pain for Christ's sake does not mean that I shall participate in my own degradation. It means that I must witness to the equality of all humanity before God in words as well as deeds. If I am a child of God, a sister in Christ, and belong with all of you to the priesthood of all believers, then my job is to love, not hate, to be creative, not destructive, to follow Christ's cross. This is the lesson of the great prophets down through the ages," in a sermon called "To Speak a Defiant Word." Come on. And we're back to the prophet and the summons of the gospel of Jesus, calling us to bring justice and righteousness to the world in which we inhabit. We have heard how that has sparked in others. When you think of the poets, these prophets, the way they give their gifts and talents, skills, voice, and life to justice and righteousness. The question, or a question for us, would be this: what does this redemptive, subversive, amazing grace form in you and me? What is this birth in us when we are struck by the good news of Christ? Maybe, as some suggestion, this Jesus justice is born through music. Next slide. Maybe it's the PTA, or civil rights law, or meals for the single mom across the street, or starting after-school mentoring for your neighborhood, or running for city council, or taking over the spring musical at your kid's school, or calling people by their name and not the label that empire places on them, or inviting one person to lunch or dinner who is vastly different than you so you can simply listen to their story. What does the gospel of Christ spark in you? And with that, I take all of that and make it into a summary that I would say this: Caesar counts in order to control and consume. Christ counts to announce belonging for the beloved, which is the only name that is given to everyone. Beloved, is that how you see people? Is that how you approach people? Is that how you sit and listen to people? You are a beloved of the divine. Do we begin there? Justice and righteousness. This is the invitation of the prophet. This is the invitation of the gospel of Jesus, who is the Christ, the King of Kings, who does not take a census to tax people, who instead counts people, who says, "You are created in the image of the divine. You count. That's how I count," says the King of Kings. So with that, we actually are going to step into a time and create space, as we have before a couple weeks ago, and just to listen to what we call prayers of the people. It's an opportunity. The way I've been thinking about it this week is for us to listen with love. That we would listen in love to the aches, the hurts, the frustrations of people in our community. And the celebrations. Man, I'm seeing justice and righteousness in this way. Good news has happened through this action, these people. This happened this week. I sat with somebody, and so it can be a celebration. It could be, oh my goodness, it's happening. And I witnessed it. I saw it. I heard it, and I needed it. Or maybe it's my heart is broken. It's aching because there's something missing, loss. So we're going to take some time. We'll turn off the sound on the camera. We'll turn things off so as we listen to the prayers of the people, we hear that. We're not announcing that.
I don't think we have to say much in terms of the importance of creating space for all of it. And I think of, obviously, stories that are told and things, just things that we don't even know, but things that are on our hearts then, and the way that goes, and how much that can move and shift, and all of the things that are happening in each of your lives and our lives, and the importance of creating space for that. I feel that for even myself in this week, it was these ping pongs of back and forth. I've said it before. We had started a church in Muskegon, and we're there for a little over a decade. And in that time, it was working with a lot of urban youth, and so I was always trying to think of bringing in folks that be able to connect with people a little bit better. And so I knew a young man. He was in his early 20s, and he had a lot of tattoos all over him, and he had a phenomenal skateboard ministry, and he loved to skateboard. And so we had him come in, and he did some beatboxing and did some skateboard stuff with some of our youth, and it was really powerful, and it was really good, and was really proud of this young man and all that he had was developing and doing. And then he got married and had his wife had three little kids, and they're 33 years old, and she passed away on Thursday of cancer. That came on like that at 33 years old. And now he is a single dad to these three kids. And you have this, oh, and it just hit me in such a way that I was angry, frustrated, just hurt for them in the midst of that, the kids, obviously, and for him. And then the next day, I get a text of good news. And then the next day, yesterday morning, is meeting with somebody and listening to someone talk about growing in God and hungering for more and this beauty. And it's like death happens and life and growth and loss. And we have this in each seat here. In each person, you experience this, and to create space so we're not just moving on. We're not a community that says, oh, it's time to go. Instead, we want to create space for God to move in, for the Christ of justice and righteousness to move in and shift and transform and heal and love us and obliterate categories that make people less, or labels, or small, or make us bigger, or more distant, so I don't have to think about. Instead, we have to think about, and we are faced with, and we then wrestle with, and then we invite our community to cry out with us in celebration and in loss, because we need it all, and certainly don't want us to go it alone. So I invite you all to just continue to have open hearts and ears to what did you hear this morning? And what sticks and what moves? And do you need to go get someone's phone number so you can call them or text them or follow up with them or grab a coffee with them and say, tell me more? or tell me how I can be with you in this, or here are some suggestions on how you might allow that door, that crack in your heart, to maybe go a bit wider and a bit bigger. And make room for the Christ. So I'd love to kind of close us in that, and then that we would spend a little bit of a few minutes reflecting in song with this invitation. Gracious God, you are good and you are here. And these are the prayers of your people. Prayers of hurt, prayers for healing, prayers for wholeness, prayers for justice and righteousness, prayers of just ache and loss. And not wanting to be alone. Or not wanting to stay put in a place. Prayers for others who are struggling, who are hurting, who are in situations that we feel, God, in this moment, helpless. In all of it, we cry to you that you will be as only you can be. May we all be met here and now by you and in you. May we cling to, find, experience, uncover, discover, rediscover hope in your goodness, in your love, and we are not aloneness. As you are, God, continue to be with us. May we then be with you in the midst of this. I'm grateful for all the voices, all the hearts that have been poured out this morning. Again, these are the prayers of your people, and we give this to you in the grace and peace and goodness of your Son, Jesus. Amen.